Srimad Bhagavad Gita, chapter 17, the divisions of faith, text number 14. So we recite the Sanskrit together. Deva Dvija Guru Pragya. Pujanam Socham Arjavam. Brahmacharyam Ahimsam Cha. Sri Ram Tapa Uchate. Deva, of the Supreme Lord, Dvija, the Brahmanas, Guru, the spiritual master, Pragya, the unworshipable personalities, Pujanam, worship, Saucham, cleanliness, Arjavam, simplicity, Brahmacharyam, celibacy, Ahimsa, non-violence, Cha, also, Shriram, pertaining to the body, Tapa, austerity, Uchite, is said to be. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. Austerity of the body consists in worship of the Supreme Lord, the Brahmanas, the spiritual master, and superiors like the father and mother, and in cleanliness, simplicity, celibacy, and nonviolence. Purport. The Supreme Godhead here explains the different kinds of austerity and penance. First, he explains the austerities and penances practiced by the body. One should offer or learn to offer respect to God or to the demigods, the perfect, qualified brahmanas, and the spiritual master, and superiors like father, mother, or any person who is conversant with Vedic knowledge. These should be given proper respect. One should practice cleansing oneself externally and internally and should learn to become simple in behavior. He should not do anything which is not sanctioned by the scriptural injunctions. He should not indulge in sex outside married life, for sex is sanctioned in the scripture only in marriage, not otherwise. This is called celibacy. These are penances and austerities as far as the body is concerned. Text again. Deva Dvija Guru Pragya Pujanam Socham Arjivam Brahmacharyam Ahimsam Cha Shriram Tapa Uchite. Austerity of the body consists in worship of the Supreme Lord, the Brahmanas, the spiritual master, and superiors like father and mother, and in cleanliness, simplicity, celibacy, and nonviolence. So I'd like to welcome our guests who have come. I hope you understand my English. We're just starting, so we'll find out later. So my name is Prahlad Anandaswamy, and if you can't remember that, most people can't. So Maharaj is also a title. This Bhagavad Gita was spoken 5,000 years ago by Lord Krishna, and it has 700 verses. And when we were at the end of the Bhagavad Gita, in the 17th chapter, it's assumed that more or less anyone who's gotten to the 17th chapter has probably read the other 16 at least. Therefore, it may not be so comprehensible exactly what Krishna is referring to in terms of worship, using the body for cleanliness, for worship of the spiritual master, the Brahmins, celibacy, etc. The Bhagavad Gita is actually a simple book in the sense that its message is quite simple. But it takes some assimilation of its philosophy in order to reach the platform of simplicity. Just like if one wants to study physics, I studied physics in high school. I didn't study in college, but it can be quite daunting at first trying to understand the principles of physics. Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, I was always quite uncertain about that principle. Things like quantum mechanics, quarks, etc. But it is hoped that by the time you finish your PhD degree, you understand something about what they're talking about. After working on it for some years and assimilating the knowledge, you might understand something they're referring to. One man asked our spiritual teacher, Srila Prabhupada, can you tell me your philosophy in a couple of minutes? And Prabhupada said, well, that's like asking, going to a physics lecture in high school and asking the teacher, can you tell me something, can you summarize physics in two lines? Maybe it's possible, but it's unlikely the person would understand what he was talking about. But Bhagavad Gita, if we summarize its contents, as Prabhupada does in the fourth chapter of this book, he says that actually there are two different levels of knowledge. Bhagavad Gita deals with two levels. The eternality of the self, knowledge of ourselves, and the Supreme Personality of Godhead. If you understood both those things, you've understood everything in Bhagavad Gita. Now, of course, when we approach Bhagavad Gita, we try to approach it with our intelligence. It is not a book of faith alone. But some faith has to be there, otherwise there's no sense of reading the Bhagavad Gita if we reject it right away. Whatever Krishna says must be wrong, because Krishna is saying exactly what we don't want him to say, that he's God. Of course, everyone thinks in this world that they're God, so if Krishna thinks he's God, that's all right too. But he actually takes it seriously. So either he has a psychological condition, like many people have, that leads him to believe he's God, or maybe he is God. So Prabhupada writes at the beginning of the Bhagavad Gita that one lady had approached him and asked our spiritual teacher to recommend an edition in English of the Bhagavad Gita. But Prabhupada said, I'm sorry, I can't recommend an edition, because everyone who's translated and given a commentary in the Bhagavad Gita has given their own imaginative understanding of what the Bhagavad Gita is. Now Krishna, he says he's God, and most of the 700 translations and commentaries try to dispute the fact that Krishna is God. But that's not very fair. I mean, if I told you I came from New York, probably by my accent you might believe me, but if you spent the whole time talking to me trying to disprove I came from New York, it wouldn't be a very fruitful conversation. So Prabhupada writes that actually great personalities in the past, they've accepted Krishna as the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and they've written great intelligent works on their own of philosophy, which are honored by many people, and therefore they're recognized as great personalities, great saints. Still, we don't know them personally. We may not have met them. Maybe we haven't read their books. So we may not accept them as authorities. But Prabhupada said, but still, the minimum, if we want to derive any benefit from reading the Bhagavad Gita or hearing it, at least theoretically, we should accept what Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita. We don't have to blindly accept it, but then why should we blindly reject it? Now, from the very beginning of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna mentions in his first instruction the principle that we ourselves, that's all of us that are here and all of us that are not here, we're all eternal. Now, he doesn't just tell us we're eternal. He gives us an example from our own experience. And with our intelligence, we can judge whether he's correct or not. In other words, Krishna is not asking us to blindly accept anything he says, but he's asking us to use our intelligence and trying to give some means by which, if we use our intelligence, we're able to perceive to some extent what he's saying. Because one of the principles in the Bhagavad Gita is that if we had full intelligence, we wouldn't have to read the Bhagavad Gita, because we'd see everything perfectly. Supposedly, we go to school to develop our intelligence. We take information by reading books to develop our intelligence. So that means our intelligence is something that has to be developed. Still, we can judge our intelligence, our spiritual intelligence, by Krishna's first instruction, where he says in Sanskrit, Dainasminita dehe kamaram yovanam jara tatadahantara praptir diryas tatra namuyati. That as the embodied soul, and he's referring to us, by the way, each one of us, we're embodied souls, as we continually pass in a body which is going from boyhood to youth and old age. Krishna also applies girlhood, youth, and old age. So similarly, the soul will pass into another body at the time of death. The self-realized souls are not bewildered by such a change. So one thing we're aware of is the fact that we exist. Who is the philosopher who said, I think, therefore I am? Descartes, that's right. So, if you don't believe you exist, then this lecture is not going to be very valuable for you. If you don't believe you're here or anywhere, then there's not much we can tell you. So there's a basic axiomatic principle that we do exist. And anyone who believes that, they might be able to gain some value from this lecture. So Krishna says we're existing, and all of us probably can agree, when we walked into this room, we were existing. We didn't just appear right now. So although we walked into the room, we were existing, and we're existing now, and hopefully by the time the lecture is done, we're also still existing. But still, our bodies are always changing. As a matter of fact, the whole world is changing. Don't think we're picking on your body. The whole world is changing at every moment. Everything's changing. And yet we're not changing. Now, that doesn't mean that our experience is not changing. As a matter of fact, as the world changes, our experiences change. For instance, now supposedly it's getting towards summer. So our experience in the world is changing. It's lighter, it's warmer. And similarly, the atmosphere is different. The birds may come out. I haven't heard them lately. But anyhow, the birds will come, and it's a whole different experience. But we ourselves, we've gone through so many summers, and therefore we know more or less know what to expect. Summer will be different this year, but we're the same. And we can compare this summer to our last summer, to the one before that, etc., etc. So we're not actually changing. Our experience changes. Our senses, what we're experiencing, changes. When we're younger, we can jump higher. Maybe we're hungry when we're younger. And our conception is different, hopefully. I mean, surely when we were 3 years old, we had a different conception than we have now. So these things are changing. Our experience through our senses, our minds, the way we feel about things. We're usually more tolerant when we get older. We're not so agitated by everything that disagrees with us or we don't like. We can see things in a different perspective by education. We see people more equally. We're more appreciative of some people. So our mood, our experience, our values, everything is changing. But the person who has this experience, ourselves, and our view of the world, and our feelings, those have changed. But we haven't changed because we're experiencing them. So that's the first point. As this body changes, we're not changing. So therefore, Krishna says, the final change is called death. So as this body has not affected us as a spiritual being, as an observer, we could say, as an experiencer, so similarly, the final change of the body called death will also not change us. We'll simply go and take another body. Now, Krishna is talking from the point of view of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Now, that's what he claims. Now, Krishna doesn't reveal himself just because we tell him, well, you're telling us that you're God in Bhagavad Gita, so please reveal yourself to me right now and then I'll believe you. Otherwise, how can I believe you? Because I have no experience of you. You're just claiming you're God. So Krishna doesn't say that just by demanding that he reveal himself, that that's what he's going to do. Because he said there are some basic obstacles for our realizing God. But he says, if we use our intelligence, at least we can understand that he's there, someone's there who's God. We may not say it's him personally or directly, we don't know, the speaker of Bhagavad Gita, and we may not even know what God means. According to Bhagavad Gita, God means the person who's the source of everything. So Krishna tries to use some logic and reasoning so we can understand there is someone who's the source of everything, logically speaking. That everything didn't come out of nothing, and that, for instance, from our own experience, every one of us had a father and mother. Isn't that right? Is that up to dispute? Everything's up to dispute nowadays. I don't know. People may say, well, I didn't have a father. I don't agree. Anyhow, most reasonable people accept they had a father and mother, and they probably accept that their father and mother had a father and mother. And it all goes all the way back. Now the question is, if everyone had a father and mother, where do you stop? And the last person in line, or the first person in line, wasn't a person. In other words, if everyone down the line we can accept was a person, how could the last person not be a person? Although there are some people who disagree. They think we came from the monkeys. In other words, if we really look back in our family album, we look carefully and we turn in the pages and there's our grandparents and they were in the army and she was a cook, our grandmother, and we turn the page. We keep on turning the pages, and then there's some strange ancestor covered with hair with one hand on a branch of something. And that was great-great-great-grandfather Harry. And his grandmother, his great-great-great-grandmother was Lucy. And that seems scientific. That's what they tell us in school. A little surprising. But anyhow, he has a big smile on his face. And then we keep on turning the pages, and we find all kinds of different living entities on the pages. And there's a sheep, and we recognize the sheep because it's black. And that's the black sheep in the family that everyone talks about. And it's beginning to make some sense till we get to great-grandfather Squeaky. He's a mouse. And the most surprising thing is when we turn the page and there's just a rock. And we look up on a scientific book and say, yeah, that's right. We all came out of the rock. And the last page, there's nothing on it. And there, yeah, that's scientific, all right. Nothing. We came from nothing. But how did from nothing came the rock? And how did from the rock came the mouse, etc.? So the explanation is, possible explanation, is that everyone has to have a father and mother, so Nothing also had a father and mother. But Mother Nothing told Son Nothing, why don't you make something out of yourself? So it's very difficult to make something out of yourself when you're nothing. You have to really try hard. But he had a lot of time because Nothing had nothing to do. Which is not surprising. So after a long, long time, he finally figured out how to make something out of himself. So he became a rock. So his mother, actually he became some gas. But finally he became a rock. So his mother, Nothing, was rather dissatisfied. And she said, well, I mean, that's a solid beginning. But it's not very much. So, Son Rock, after all that endeavor, he couldn't please his mother, so he became angry, so he exploded. And he went all over the universe, and his mother said, all right, just take it easy, settle down. So he settled down, and here we are. So this is called science. Of course, in our philosophy, it's called science fiction, but there are different types of science. So Krishna says, actually, if we trace our ancestry, it'd be very unusual to find anyone in our family who's a monkey, although some of our parents may think like that. But actually, most human beings give birth to human beings, and monkeys give birth to monkeys, etc. So it's just logical that the original person was also a person. Otherwise, how do we become person if he wasn't a person? Now, on the other hand, if we want to look at the universe, we can see that the many amazing things are going on. Like, for instance, the sun is rising at its appointed time and the sun setting at its appointed time. Snowflakes are falling in precise geometric patterns, and there are no two snowflakes exactly the same. That there are amazing things going on beyond the capacity of any ordinary person with intelligence. Even the most intelligent people can't duplicate what's going on around us. For instance, if the scientists can make a male machine and a female machine, and when they got together, they made little machines. That would be a really great accomplishment on the scientists' part. So far, they haven't been able to accomplish that. For instance, if the scientists can make a male Rolls-Royce and a female Rolls-Royce, and when they got together, they made little Rolls-Royces. That way, everyone can get a Rolls-Royce. It would be rather inexpensive. But they can't do that. All they can do is talk about it. But God, Krishna, he's made male and female forms in millions of species of life, and they make little form. They get together and they make little duplicates of themselves, and life goes on. Or as another example, if scientists could create a machine that you put grass in one end and the other end you get milk, it would be a very nice machine, especially if you're not a vegan. Of course, if you were a vegan, if they made such a machine, it wouldn't be a problem. But they can't do that. But Krishna has done that. Unfortunately, they don't appreciate his creation. It's called the cow. You put grass in one end, and the other end you get milk. So there are many amazing things going on. For instance, even in our own bodies, we eat food, and hopefully it becomes assimilated. The unnecessary parts are eliminated, and that carrot may eventually become our stomach or our brain or whatever. It's transformed itself miraculously. Now let the scientists transform a carrot into a person. We'd really appreciate it. they're trying, but they haven't been able to duplicate. And even if they could do it, it's already been done in unlimited species of life, practically speaking. So what's the great credit? If the scientists could spend a billion, trillion, quadrillion dollars or euros to create one blade of grass, would you pay for it? I could give you a blade of grass. I only asked for 100 euros. But they're trying to do it, and it's costing billions of euros. So the point is, if we use our intelligence, we can perceive that there is an intelligent being beyond our conception who is running the place that we happen to be inhabitants of. For instance, if the sun moved a little closer to the earth, then everything would burn up. Or if it moved a little bit further away, then everything would freeze. So what is the power, what is the intelligence that allows the sun to rise at a certain time exactly? We can predict it for hundreds of years from now, and then go down exactly in time. And yet the sun doesn't move 1 inch closer to this earth or 1 inch further away. So who's the intelligence behind that? For instance, in India, sometimes they attach a bull by its nose with a rope to a pole. And then the bull walks around an area with a heavy weight behind it and crushing grains. Now this bull is so powerful that it can pull a weight which 40 strong people could not pull. And yet, although it's so powerful, it cannot move 1 inch beyond the rope. So the sun is, although it's full of infinite effulgence, giving us heat and light unlimitedly, still it's not moving 1 inch beyond its orbit. So who's the intelligence that made this arrangement that allows us to get sunshine and heat within a predictable orbit, within every day? Seasons are changing, everything's changing. And yet, it gives us exactly what we need to survive on this planet. Now, of course, they claim it's all an accident. Everything's an accident, they claim. All these wonderful things are all accidents. But they can't even produce even one accident with all their intelligence. Now, if they had the intelligence to figure out that it was an accident, they should know how the accident occurred. For instance, if you're walking in the street and two cars clash with each other and the police come and the police say, well, what happened? And the response is, well, it was just an accident, don't worry about it. It was just an accident. No, the police want to find out how the accident occurred. If you claim it's an accident, there must be a cause behind the accident. So if the scientists claim everything is just an accident, the whole thing, this miraculous material existence that we're in is just an accident, then why do they spend so much time going to the university to get their PhD degree? If the whole universe could come about by accident, why can't they get the PhD by accident? Why don't they stay at home and by accident they'll become a millionaire? If everything's just an accident, why are they working so hard? Do you really have to work hard to have an accident? So, in other words, the philosophy is not blind philosophy, but it's intelligent philosophy. Now, how to realize this, because right now we're just talking theoretically, although intelligently, that there's a person behind the creation. But how to meet that person? That's the question. So here in this particular verse that we read, it's not talking about something which is beyond our capacity to achieve. In other words, in the Bhagavad Gita, it starts with what we can do at the present moment to what we might be able to do in the future when we're more qualified. So in the beginning, for instance, it mentions that there are three modes of nature called goodness, passion, ignorance. And according to ignorance means laziness, sleep, illusion, the type of experience one gets by taking a lot of intoxication. I mean, I guess if you go to university or you go to work, most of the time, if you want to be sharp and alert and understand what's going on, you don't take a whole lot of intoxication. So intoxication generally, although it was claimed at some time that it would increase your awareness, like I remember I had friends, I mean, when I grew up, they were just getting into this idea of LSD, although the university I went to wasn't available so easily. But I had friends who had taken LSD, and some of them thought it was illumination. So they wanted ever stronger doses, so they came up with something called STP. STP was supposed to be 1,000 times stronger than LSD. So they took it, and they got exactly what they wanted. And I'm sure if they're still alive, they're still on the same acid trip that they took 50 years ago. But I don't think they were any more enlightened, in reality at least, than they were before they took it. The other mode of nature, that's called ignorance. The other mode of nature is called passion. Sometimes when I was in the airport distributing books, people would run by, they wouldn't stop and listen to us. They said they were in a hurry, they had to catch their plane. And then 5 minutes later, they ran in the opposite direction. Because they were so much in a hurry, they didn't even look at their ticket to find out where the gate was. They just madly rushed in a certain direction. So this idea of making progress by working harder is not always true. For instance, if you're in a city and you're driving your car and you have an appointment and you're driving, but you have the wrong map of the city. So you're trying to figure out where to go. Really trying hard, following the map. You can't figure it out, so you call your friend. You say, oh, I'm trying to find out. You gave me this map, but I can't figure out how to get to where I want to go. So your friend says, well, just become more determined. Just work harder. So you get back in your car, you drive faster. And you call your friend, I'm going faster, I'm going more with more determination, but I just can't find the place. So your friend says, think positive, don't be so negative. So then you get back in your car, I'm going to find it, doesn't matter, I'm going to find it following this map. Well, you never find it because you have the wrong map. It doesn't matter how quick you go, how much you're thinking positive, you just have the wrong map. So the right map is called the mode of goodness, where our consciousness becomes purified and we can understand things like how our body's changing, but we're not changing. Clearer. It becomes more obvious. So here, that's what Krishna is describing in this particular verse about how to utilize the body. For instance, Krishna even makes the claim that if we keep our body clean, then we might even become more intelligent spiritually. We might become more alert, at least. And if we're, for instance, he said, Deva Dvija Guru Pragya. If we want to learn from someone, then we should be a little bit respectful. Like, for instance, luckily, you didn't come here with some tomatoes and throw them at me while I was giving the lecture. Because then it would be very difficult to concentrate on the lecture, both for me and for yourselves. So therefore, a certain amount of respect has to be there. That's why we have these chairs, by the way. It's not that I need a special amount of air to speak, or that the air is better up here. No, the reason why they put us on chairs when we're speaking, anyone who speaks on this book, Bhagavad Gita, they sit on this chair just to invoke a certain amount of respect so that people will listen, that's all. Now, I can read the Bhagavad Gita from here or there or anywhere. It doesn't make any difference to me. Well, to anyone who reads Bhagavad Gita, exactly how high, it's not that when you're a little bit above the ground, the Bhagavad Gita makes more sense. But just to give a little respect to the speaker, because to value the book and to value the speaker's understanding, there's some respect shown. So that's what Krishna is saying. If we want to hear better, if we want to think better, if we want to act better, if we want to become, for instance, if we're not clean, then the body's going to give us some disturbance. If you don't believe me, don't take a shower for a couple of weeks and then see how you feel. See how everyone else feels too. It creates a disturbance for one's physical body. And therefore, instead of being able to concentrate on hearing whatever we're trying to hear, not only Bhagavad Gita, but anything we're trying to learn, it becomes a disturbance if our skin is itchy all the time, if everyone's running away whenever we approach them to ask them something. So therefore, certain basic things in the mode of goodness are helpful to be able to hear better, to be able to live better, etc. So this is what Krishna is saying, austerity of the body. Deva dvija guru pragya pujanam socham arjumam. Socham means clean. Cleanliness and arjumam, simplicity. If you go on the internet and you try to find out what's a good methodology of organizing your workplace, they don't usually say clutter it up with all kinds of books and just throw everything in different corners and whatever else and sit down and you'll be able to concentrate. They usually say organize things, make it simple, concentrate on what you're trying to do, put it in an order, etc., and then you'll be able to accomplish things much better. So that's what Krishna is saying here, arjavam, simplicity. Brahmacharya himsam cha. Himsa means, rather than every time we look at someone, we're trying to figure out how to, negative thoughts about them, to think about how to help people. It's much easier to help people if you want to help them. Ahimsa, non-violence, means that one should not put people into distress. And ultimately, non-violence, according to Krishna, is to help people elevate their consciousness to understand things better, especially in the human form of life, so they can work better in this world, more productively, more beneficially. That the aim of Bhagavad Gita, the aim of the philosophy, is only three things. To teach people how to become as happy as possible for as long as possible. That's called knowledge. Therefore, even people manufacture things which put people in distress, it's usually to put other people in distress to make oneself happy. For instance, in this world nowadays, so much money in some countries is spent for armaments. It's actually to make themselves happy, although it may make other people unhappy. But basically speaking, everyone at least wants to make themselves happy, and people they care about or appreciate or can relate to happy. So basically speaking, life is meant, it's a path of trying to find happiness as long as possible. So Bhagavad Gita is promising at the end, if we take to it properly, then we'll find unlimited happiness forever. That's the kind of knowledge at least it claims to have. So part of that is this attempt to come to higher consciousness. In other words, the whole attempt, for instance, in this verse, is not just washing our hands for the sake of washing our hands. It's washing our hands so that we can prepare ourselves to hear higher states of knowledge and become receptive to them, to ultimately go beyond just ordinary happiness to spiritual happiness. And spiritual happiness, as opposed to material happiness, goes on perpetually, as we're eternal, so we'd like eternal happiness. And if knowledge is perfect, then Bhagavad Gita, for instance, Krishna claims he's the source of everything, which means that he should be the source of all beauty, all wealth, all strength, all fame, all knowledge, and all renunciation. So we can't see Krishna at the present moment. We may not be able to see how beautiful he is. We can't judge how strong he is. We can't understand how famous he is, or how renounced he is, or how wealthy he is. But if we read Bhagavad Gita, we can find out, we can examine it with our intelligence. We can put into practice what he says and see if our intelligence doesn't increase, or our experience doesn't increase, and then we can see if Krishna, what he's speaking, is perfect knowledge. Because if he's perfect, as he claims he is, his knowledge should be perfect. And if it's not perfect, then what's the sense of reading Bhagavad Gita? Unless you have nothing else to do, you can read Bhagavad Gita, but then Krishna's claim to be God wouldn't be valid if it's the knowledge he's giving us isn't perfect. And that we can judge for ourselves. I may say something, I may claim it's perfect knowledge, but that would not really necessarily make any difference to you. That's my experience. But Bhagavad Gita is meant to give everyone the same experience, anyone who follows it. And it can take from this beginning to the end and examine it with our intelligence and see whether it makes sense to us or not. Whether it's something we can apply practically in our lives to make a difference in our lives. To make a difference in our lives means to make our lives more happy, at least more peaceful. Because if we can't become peaceful, what's the question of happiness? And more productive, in a way that productive meaning to make other people's lives more peaceful and happy also. So that's the challenge of Bhagavad Gita. That's why we distribute it. That's why we speak about it. And everyone's invited to share with it. That's all. So I'll stop there. Thank you. Any questions or comments? Yes. As usual.
From early, there was two questions. One is why Krishna is blue, and the second, why on this picture there is 8 of gopis, so if this 8 number is some specific number.
Well, there's actually 10, but they're off on the side. You can't see them.
Okay.
No, there's 8 because that's all they could fit into the picture. But there are unlimited gopis. There's not 8. Matter of fact, we might be gopis also in our spiritual life, in our spiritual bodies, and maybe next picture we'll be in there too. As far as why this Krishna is blue, well, he's many colors. He's not only blue. Krishna is not limited to being blue. He comes also in different colors. But blue is his original color. Kind of, it's just, why? That you have to ask his mother, I can't tell you. But if he's, I think Mother Jasoda, because Krishna is eternally blue and his mother is also eternal, the same color, so. It runs in the family. Anything else? Okay, thank you very much. Kuala, Granth Raj, Bhagavad Gita, Ki Jai.